Summer's hotter weather is finally here, but don't let hair loss also make you sweat. Regrow hair with the help of Hims. They provide access to personalized treatments so you can see thicker, fuller hair in just 3 to 6 months. Yeah, 3 to 6 months. That's it, kids. Hims offers convenient access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work, including chews, oral medications, serums, and sprays, doctor-trusted, clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil can stop hair loss and regrow your hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Get started from the comfort of your own home. Fill out an intake form, and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. The process is 100% online, which means getting started has never been more convenient. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. Plus, treatment options start at $35 per month. Hims has helped hundreds of thousands of men get their confidence back with visibly thicker and fuller hair. Start your free online visit today at Hims.com/drinking bros. That is Hims.com/drinking bros for personalized hair loss treatment options. Hims.com/drinking bros. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. Let me tell you about Moo.com. Promo code Drinking Bros. Gonna get you 20% off your first order over there. Did you know there's an online cannabis store that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern you can think of. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. Whether that's the magic mind gummies for deep work and creativity, the PMS support to ease cramps and balance mood swings, or their sexual euphoria gummies to help you feel ready for the action at every turn, and touch into a full body experience over there. Listen, I love the night-night gummies, as I call them, the sleepy time gummies. I take, right now they're 15 milligrams. I cut it in half, and I take half a night. 15 minutes, dude, you are gone. I've never had anything like it. 15, 20 minutes tops, and I'm out. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days, gas stations, whatever. Mood's functional gummies, though, combine premium federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. Plus, Texas Governor Abbott just said it was all right to get these shipped through the mail. He vetoed the bill down here. Thank God. So order from mood.com today. Use that promo code Drinking Bros for 20% off your first order. Everything ships discreetly right to your front door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with the promo code Drinking Bros. So head on over to mood.com. Find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Don't forget to use the promo code Drinking Bros when you check out to save 20% off your first order.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely smoothly and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1-pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to AeroHit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Sit back, relax, and grab a fucking drink.
Life on the front lines requires you to step up your game. Owned and operated by former Navy SEAL Sean Mattson, Cardomax has designed just the right supplements for you and is offering Drinking Bros an exclusive offer. Buy one, get one free on your first order. Go to Cardomax.com and use the promo code DB. That's Cardomax.com, helping you achieve your max.
Welcome to Drinking Bros, kids. Today, I got a little inspiration in the house. If you want to learn about winning, you should learn from the best. We've got Tim Grover here, who is the man behind the relentless pursuits of Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, Dwayne Wade. We just saw you on The Last Dance. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing excellent. How about yourself?
I'm fantastic. If you would have said anything other than excellent, I said that before you came on, I would have been shocked.
And if you would have said anything other than fantastic, because we don't settle for good, average, any of that stuff. We don't.
Never. You can't. Life is more than waking up and writing hashtag grindfather next to a Starbucks cup on Instagram, which is what everybody does in this world. I'm a huge fan. It's an honor to have you on the show. You're one of these guys that rarely do I meet that I sync up with mentally. But when you hear the words out loud and you say the words out loud of what you actually believe in this world, people look at you crazy. I always tell people I hate losing. I fucking hate it. It is the worst thing in the world to me. There's nothing. I don't care what it is in this life. I do not want to lose. Another thing that you're big on is showing up is half the battle, which is bullshit. You should always show up. Like there's no reason not to show up every day.
We're going to get along fantastic on this show. Unbelievable. Because I hate to lose also. And everything that you hear out there, it's supposed to motivate you. It's supposed to propel you forward. And it does completely the opposite. Mm-hmm. We hear these things all the time. Here's another one that says, you know, follow your passion. Follow your passion. What are you going to just follow it aimlessly? No, work on your passion. Excel on your passion, what it is. Don't freaking follow it. You've been following something your whole life that hasn't been getting you where you want to go. And the same thing that you said, you know, showing up is half the battle. No, showing up is none of the battle. It's none of the battle. And people love to have those moral victories. Yes, I showed up. I won.
Yeah.
No, you didn't win anything. You didn't win a damn thing.
Yeah, and I openly say it to people's faces too, and they get insulted by it. True story, lost a lawsuit, a few weeks back, and I was on the phone with the attorneys, kind of wrapping up everything and everything else, and he had said to me, he was just like, you know, what do you really care? You have the money for this or whatever, and I said, hey man, I care because you fucking lost, and I go, you are a fucking loser. I go, not in life. You're a lawyer, you went to law school, you did all the things, and you make money, and you're successful, and I use air quotes in front of them. I said, you're successful, but you're a fucking loser, and you allowed this loss to happen without it really making a dent in who you are as a person. And there was just stone-cold silence after that. And I go,
'cause you told the truth.
Yeah.
You told him the truth. And you figure, it's funny, everybody asks for honesty until you're honest. And winning requires you not only to be honest with everybody else, but requires you to be honest with yourself. And you would figure that if you're honest with somebody, it would lead to more uplifting. It would lead to elevation. It would lead to a better result. And what does honesty usually lead to? More emotions. Exactly what you said. He became quiet. He was just like, oh, my feelings were hurt. Everybody wants you to be honest until it's time to be honest. Then when you're honest with them, it's your fault. Why did you tell me that? Winners are always honest with every single one. Like you said, in The Last Dance, Michael was brutally honest. Mm-hmm. Brutally honest. Look at the end result.
Yeah.
Look at the end result.
I get a serious question for you, because I have this debate with my wife all the time. I don't think you can be successful in this world without being an asshole. That is the biggest debate in our household over the way you deal with people in real life, because it's hard when you deal with so many people who are unmotivated to do their job, whatever their job is in this world. Just be the best at it. I don't give a shit if you're working at McDonald's or if you're raking leaves or you're, you know, running Forbes, whatever it is, just do the best you possibly can. Yeah. I don't know anyone who wasn't an asshole along the way. And you know, since we were talking about The Last Dance, I know Michael took some flack for that and you know, Kobe and all these other guys. But how do you achieve greatness without being an asshole?
You can't. I'll give you a great example. So when I was done with Michael in 2007, Kobe reached out to MJ and just said, "Hey, man, my knees are like really killing me. I don't know if I can keep going." And he goes, "Well, listen, I'm not using Grover anymore. Why don't you think about bringing him in?" So Kobe goes to MJ and he goes, "Hey, tell me about Grover." And he goes, "Man, Grover really knows his stuff, but he is the biggest asshole you'll ever meet." that was the best compliment I could get, because he didn't call me a asshole. He called me the asshole. And by what he meant by that is like, listen, he's going to hold you accountable. He's going to tell you the truth. He's not going to be a yes person that's always going to be worried about, you know, "Oh man, I can't say this to him. I can't hold this person accountable." That's what he meant. And it was funny when I got to Kobe, and Kobe said, "That's exactly the person I need." And then when I got started with Kobe, a media individual asked Kobe, said, "Hey, you're working with MJ's guy." He goes, "Well, how do you feel about that?" He goes, "I don't fucking know. He ain't done shit for me yet."
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He goes, "Yeah, whatever he did for Michael, he ain't done it for me. I don't know." He goes, ask me at the end of the year. The people that are called the assholes, we thrive on that pressure. We thrive on that. We don't worry about people. We don't worry about stepping on people's toes, because we're so busy stepping on their throats, not literally, but with our results. And that's what pisses people off more and more, because once you start creating separation from those individuals, they're still left in the middle of the pack and they don't even know what a win looks like. And you continue to work and you start to separate yourself and you're no longer doing the same things they're doing. You're no longer agreeing with everybody. They're saying the same thing you said about the Starbucks thing. You're no longer hashtagging what everybody else is hashtagging. You're creating a hashtag that's unique to you, which is unique to winning. Oh, he's an asshole. She's an asshole. Whatever. You know, they don't want to be part of the group. No, they don't want to come down to your level. They want you to come up to your level.
Yeah.
Where we're at.
Yeah. And, you know, for me personally, even though, look, I'm a writer, I'm in podcasts and all that other stuff, I still want to be the best. I want to be number one. I've talked about this on a previous episode where in my life, when I've looked back on it, I've been number one in the world twice at two things in my life. I was fortunate to have a number one book in the world, and I was fortunate to have a number one movie in the world that I, you know, wrote and directed and all that other stuff. Each time, I think I celebrated for maybe a day, and then I was back to work at something. The book, goddamn, I was writing that night at 4 a.m. when everybody else passed out. I think that's part of it, where just being number one for that one moment is like, oh man, most people would just celebrate and then that's it, stop, right? The guys like Jordan and Kobe and D Wade and those guys, it wasn't good enough to just do it once. You had to keep doing it. And to stay at that level is the hardest part. And that's what I enjoy. And there's 800,000 podcasts out there. I've gotten as high as number three in the world. But let's face it, I probably won't beat Rogan because of his back catalog. But God damn it, if I'm not going to get up and try every single day to have the best podcast in the world.
Every single day. This is what I always say. Listen, if you're forced enough to open your eyes and put your feet on the ground, it's a fucking great day. Everything else is up to you after that. It's a great day. And what do you settle for is strictly up to you. And it's just like, listen, if you don't go up and do your best every single day, you have no chance of catching Rogan. But if you do, those little wins each day. You never close the gap, close the gap, close the gap. That's your internal motivation. That's your fire that you don't need anybody else to light it for you. You're like, hey, number one is important to me. Winning is important to me. Winning is important to everyone. Very few people would admit it outright the way you and I will admit it, because the language of winning is completely different in your vocabulary and in my vocabulary. Everybody talks about winning and they think about the parades and they think about, you know, the confetti and all this other stuff and standing on the platform. And exactly what you said, we're there for just for a split second. For us, our language of winning, man, we know it's hard. We know it's nasty. We know it's unpolished. We know it's dirty. We know it's rough. We know it's unforgiving. We know all these things. We know it's not fair. That's our language of winning. And that's what fuels us to continue to go and go and go. Because every time you get that win, there's a new start line right there. I call this a lot of this with my athletes that I work with, the championship hangover, that they've won a championship one. And they've literally had that hangover for 10 years and they never get back to that place again. And you see all the true competitors that win over and over again, they come back better each time. You know, every time my guys would win a championship, you know, they'd celebrate, they'd come over and they'd come over me and give me a hug. And they would always say the same thing. They would whisper, "What's next?"
Yeah.
What's next? Because they know if they come back the same, they're not going to have this feeling again. And you said it, it's just for a short period of time. Because, you know, you can hold on to winning briefly, just briefly, and then starts to look for somebody else. And if you, you know, when you had that number one movie and you had that number one book, the next time you do the thing, you have to do it better than you did it the first time. Otherwise, it's not going to be number one again.
Yeah. And you know, what age do you start teaching your kids? That is the question. I did a show about my son was on this. I coached his soccer team, 6 and under. I brought the winning trophies and I had the losing trophies there. And at halftime, they were like, "Coach, what are these trophies for? How do we get the big trophies?" And I was like, "We got to win." And I was like, "What?" Yeah. They were like, "What are the other trophies?" I was like, "Those are the loser trophies. So you decide what you want to do." And there was a couple people that had messaged me after the show and they ended up winning the championship. But there's a couple of people that mentioned me and they were like, "Jesus Christ, that's ruthless for like 6-year-olds. And I was like, "Well, look, the kid's actually one of the bigger trophies. What am I supposed to say? What's the right age that you start your kids at with this mindset?"
Listen, it's different for all, but everybody has to understand competition matters. Winning does matter. Standing out does matter. It's funny, when you go, you know, if you go to a lot of these events that you set for the 6-year-olds, the participation trophy is bigger than the winning trophy. They get more people that clap for them because you participate. You don't get rewarded in life for participating. You just don't. That's settling for average. Everybody participates. Very few people stand out. What I always say with the kids and their age, if they really enjoy what they're doing, and I put this in a book, if they really enjoy what they're doing, what they're playing for, they'll be competitive as hell. All right. If they don't, find something else that they will be competitive in. You see a lot of parents, they put kids in their sports because they didn't excel at that sport. So they want to try to live through those. They want to live through those individuals. But winning matters. And so does losing. Losing teaches you different lessons. And the more you lose and how you handle those losses at an early age has a lot to do with how confident and how an individual handles adversity much later on in their life. It's true.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, you were talking about your book. In the book, your new one is out now, Winning. Your first one was one of my all-time favorites, Relentless. Yeah. But I'm glad you wrote this other book, because I still felt like there was more. After I read Relentless, yeah, I was like, I guarantee you there's more, because life doesn't stop. It keeps going. And the pursuit of winning and trying to be the best keeps going. Was that your motivation for writing this one?
Yes, exactly. This, it was like, hey, winning is in all of us. Winning is everywhere, every single minute. You know, here's the thing. I said winning is in everyone. The problem with most individuals, that's where it stays. that's where it stays. Because everybody wants to talk about the glamour of winning it, I said earlier. And this book is about the grit. It's not about the glory. It's not about the payday. It's about the obstacles and challenges and the pain that we go through to get to winning. You know, think about when you wrote that book, when you wrote that movie, you said you were writing the night of until 4 a.m.
Yeah.
All right. Just to get to that euphoric feeling of winning just for a moment. Think about all the obstacles it took you to get to there. Think about all the challenges. Think about all the mental pain that it took you to get to number one. Nobody wants to talk about that stuff. Nobody wants to talk about how hard the kids, the teams that are better at a youth age, they practice harder. The coaches hold them. The coaches hold them more accountable. That, you know, they don't let them get away with just, oh, this is just fun. Yeah, it is fun, but winning is even more fun. It is, and that makes a huge difference. And that's what this book is about. It's about the different traits that happen to individuals. One of the things I talk about is winning makes you different, and different scares people. You look at the kids and you look at the individuals, the ones that win, other individuals are intimidated by them. They're like, yeah, you know what? I don't want to hang out with them. I don't want to really do with them. I don't know what you're one of that individual. You probably don't have a lot of friends because they're like, shit, we don't know what he's going to say.
Yeah, I've got about five close friends probably in this world, 5 to 7, and that's about mm-hmm. it. And I always say the same thing. I'm like, look, I don't really need any more, to be honest with you. And I married my best friend, so I'm good on that aspect. But the rest of it is a pursuit of greatness. And I don't have fucking time. I don't have time for more friends, to be honest with you. And that means I'm not working on something. You know, and speaking of winners, you've worked with, you know, a laundry list of them. Obviously, we're going to start with Jordan. How did you guys even get hooked up in the first place? Because it is hard to penetrate that inner circle of Jordan. Even going back and watching The Last Dance again, I was just like, man, it didn't seem like he had one friend except for that one white guy who was kind of his assistant, kind of a driver. I don't really know what he did. That was the biggest takeaway for me. I was like, what did that guy do? And how did he get that job? But how did you penetrate that inner circle and get in?
That's hilarious. So it was funny. This happened back in 1989. Remember back then, no emails. You couldn't text anybody. You couldn't do any of that stuff. So I was like, all right. I had a master's degree in exercise science. I said, all right, I know what I want to do. I want to train professional athletes. So I literally wrote 14 letters to each of the players on the Chicago Bulls organization. Now there's 15 players on a roster. I wrote to 14 of them.
Who was the one you didn't?
Michael Jordan was the one I didn't write the letter to, because I'm like, all right, I've never worked with a professional athlete. I've worked with recreational athletes in all different sports, but he's not gonna want to do it. But I said, I figured if I can get one of the other players, show my results with them, then maybe he would take interest. So you mail the letters, and the letters get thrown in the fan mail pile, and they get thrown in everyone's locker. And if a player decides to open it, they open it. If they don't, they don't. So somebody, I don't know which player it was, actually opened the letter and put it in their locker. And Michael was walking by and saw the letter, and he gave it to the athletic trainer, the team physician at that time, and said, here, find out what this kid's about. I want to know what he's talking about. So I had those individuals contacted me, and they said, hey, one of our players saw the letter. He's interested in your services. We can't tell you who it is. Okay, no problem. So do you mind meeting us? So literally for 3 months, I went back and forth with these people. They gave me, you know, physical exams. They had me train other individuals. They had me take multitudes of tests and, assessments and all kinds of stuff to make sure I knew what I was doing. And then one day they just said, here, we want you to meet the client at the house. They gave me the address, be there by 1:30. I still didn't know who it was. Like, all right, no problem. All right. Now remember, I'm working at a local health club at this time, making $3.35 an hour. That's the minimum wage back then. Wow. $3.35.
Wow.
With a master's degree. All right. So I drive out there, and this was before the big gated house with the 2-3 on it and everything. I ring the doorbell. Nobody answers. I'm like, oh, hell. Ring the doorbell again. Nobody answers. Ring it the third time. Michael Jordan opens up the door.
What's your reaction?
Well, see, I'm not a starstruck person. And that's the one thing I'm not. I'm not a starstruck person. I'm one of those individuals that can, I can always kind of stay calm. And then I'm like, okay. So the first thing that comes into my mind is I'm wearing Converse. I got Lily Converse gym shoes on. And everybody knows MJ's a huge Nike guy, brand Jordan, all that other stuff. So I literally take off my shoes. I got fucking holes in my socks. Both of them. All right. I take the socks and I turn them upside down. So now I got the dirty part of the socks on the top and I got the whole holy parts on the bottom, but I leave the shoes outside. So he invites me in the house. We go downstairs to the basement and we talk for about 30, 40 minutes. He's telling me, hey, listen, I've heard a lot about you from these individuals. He goes, this is what I want to do. And I was just like, Michael, I understand what you want to do, but that's not the right way to do this. I said, this is the way we should do this. And I kind of told him what my philosophy were and the things that I wanted to do with him. And he goes up to me, he goes, man, this doesn't sound right. And I said, it doesn't get any righter. And I was like, well, obviously you can tell I'm not an English major because that's not a word. But he goes, I'll give you 30 days. He goes, I'll give you 30 days to try it out. And 30 days turned into 15 years.
Man. And, you know, in 89, that was before he started winning championships right before then. So you had to turn his body into something different because, you know, they were going up against the Pistons and those guys back in the day, and he was getting beat up. And you had to physically transform his body during that. What was he like in real life? Did you guys hang out afterwards, or was it simply about the work and then I'll see you tomorrow?
Well, you know what? Initially, it was just about the work. No, because there's a trust factor that has to be built. So initially it was just about the work. I never asked him for tickets. I never asked him for anything. I'd go do my job. I'd tell me, this is when we're going to work out. This is where we're going to show up. I would do that. As our relationship evolved, yeah, we got to see a lot. You know, I got to travel with him, got to go to all the different events, all-star games, got to spend a lot of off seasons with him, spent numerous times on golf courses, even though I didn't play golf. It was, you know, he really let me inside a part of his life that very few individuals get to see.
And in return, you never said anything about him, you know, which is probably what he liked, obviously, during that whole stretch of time. Going back to the winning mindset of this, when he won his first title, how long does a guy like that celebrate? How long does he take off from training?
All right, so what we did is we always had a set plan. Usually if you win the championships, you play until late June. Mm-hmm. This was when there was an 82-game schedule and everything was done. So Michael, his mindset was already different than everybody else's. So he would say, okay, now I basically have July and August. So we're talking about, you know, 8 weeks, maybe nine, to take care of everything, all my endorsement deals, all my travel, my family vacation, all that other stuff. Once Labor Day rolled around, so basically the first week of September, everything else shuts down. He would tell his agents, he would tell his marketing people, I don't do anything after this. Because now it's time to train and it's time to play golf. Those are the only two things I'm going to do, because the training was to get him physically and mentally right, and the golf was to allow his brain to kind of relax and be himself. So he would take probably about a month and a half, maybe two months off, and then we got right back at it. And it was like serious, serious training, getting him ready to for the next season. And each year he always said, I got to come back better. I have to come back stronger. I have to come back more resilient. We have to add something new to the game, because he wanted that feeling of winning over and over again. And that feeling you could only get from winning. It's the only way you can get it. You know, and I say, and with each win, you get more confidence, and the confidence is the ultimate drug. But the only way to get that drug is to win, because winning is the ultimate dealer on that thing.
When he decided to play baseball, did you ever say to him, I don't think you can win at this, and I don't know if you can succeed at this?
Never. I never did. And I was down there with his training him during that year and a half period of time. I was there with him. I mean, he did everything possible to be the best baseball player that he could possibly be. Obviously, it didn't work out. The only time, one of the times I did disagree with him is when he decided to come back to basketball in the middle of the season. And I had told him, I said, Michael, we don't have enough time. We don't have enough time to transition your body from baseball back into basketball. There just isn't. And he was just like, you know, no, I know I could do this. I know I could do this. And then finally in the last dance, he finally admitted it, because he had never admitted it to me in public. He finally said it in a small segment. He goes, I just didn't have enough time to get my body right. When you're that competitive and you're that accustomed to winning and all the things, you think there's no obstacle that you can overcome. You just feel like, hey, I can do this thing. And then when you find out that winning is no longer taking your call, then it's time to make that adjustment. And then when he lost that, it was against the Orlando Magic. And the funny thing was, everybody had left the arena, and there was only myself, his best friend, George, mm-hmm. and MJ. We were the only three left in the arena. And it was like midnight. And I finally said, hey, MJ, I'm getting ready to leave. I said, let me know when you want to see me. He goes, I'll see you tomorrow.
Wow.
He goes, I'll see you. Yeah, there was no like, yeah, we're going to wait. He goes, I'll see you tomorrow.
Man. I remember watching The Last Dance and watching him talk about that. It's weird to hear you say that that's the first time you heard it. Because, look, that footage has been buried for 20 years. Did you sit and watch that week after week like a fan, or did you get that in advance, the entire series?
No, I got it just like everybody else did. And the crazy part about it is, because they moved it up earlier, because there was nothing on TV, the last 2 weeks weren't even finished when they started airing it.
Really?
Yes, the last 2 weeks weren't even done. They were still editing and filming and doing all those things. It was the first time I actually heard him, because he had never said it to me, that because he's not going to admit it. But that was the first time I actually heard him say, hey, two things in during that thing I actually heard him say. One was, I didn't have enough time, and the flu game was actually the pizza that got him sick, which I've been saying forever. And I have to admit, before you even go there, I'm the one that ordered the pizza. I did order the pizza. All right. But the one thing to my defense, everybody's like, well, how dumb are you? Who would order pizza in Michael Jordan's name? I did not order the pizza in Michael Jordan's name. All right. I'm naive, but I wasn't that naive.
That's hilarious. Look, if you didn't order that pizza, though, we wouldn't have had that moment in time. So.
Yeah, hey, there you go. That's a winning attitude right there. That's a winning mindset.
You got to turn it around and say, all right, look, if you don't order the pizza, Jordan doesn't have that game six, so we're good. We're good on that. We'll switch gears here to when he went to the Wizards and he decided to come back. Was there any conversation between the two of you of like, man, you might be a little too old to come back and win a title. Why are you doing this?
You know what? There was that conversation. There was fear, but there was no doubt. And obviously things didn't work out. My job was to keep him as healthy as possible. Listen, during that time in his last year, he played all 82 games. He had a 50-point game. So there were some wins. There were some individual wins in that thing. But, you know, the results didn't come up. It's very hard for individuals who are that successful, that motivated, that interested in elevating themselves beyond everybody else. You know, there was this thing in the book where we talk about, I said, you know, be like Mike. Everybody said, you know, we had the old Gatorade slogan, be like Mike. You know, everybody wants to be like Mike. Mike didn't want to be like everybody else. So he wanted to do things that nobody else had done before. Things didn't work out the way we wanted them to work out. You know, obviously age had caught up. There were some injuries that we couldn't overcome, but you can't have any regrets. You know, if you would still had that regret, man, I wonder if I could have done this before. The one thing with winners is they do everything. They do everything because they don't want to, they rather have the failure than to have the regret of not doing what they wanted to do.
Yeah, I get it to a certain extent, but man, Lee, if he would have left on that game winner, it was such a storybook ending for his career.
I agree. You know, because it was funny the way you said it started with a jump shot with over in North Carolina, and it would have ended with a jump shot. I get it.
Yeah.
Believe me, we that's gone through my mind over and over and over again. But again, we can only control so much. You know, if you decide you had a successful career before this, mm-hmm. extremely successful career, and then like now you're going to go do something else. And people are like, you know, you shouldn't go do this. Hey, everybody's going to remember you for this, for that. You got to go out and do things your way, whether it's a win or it's not. And just doing those things for a lot of people, that is their win. That is their win. You can't leave anything on the table. You got to go do it.
No. And I understand it. I guess it's more from a fan perspective on this one. And then, you know, when Jordan retires and then you move on to Kobe Bryant, what was that like, and what was the difference between the two of them?
Well, with Michael hired me. He had this great thing. He goes, listen, everybody would ask me, hey, you know, can I use Grover? And he would say, he goes, listen, I don't pay Grover to train me. I pay him not to train anybody else. So that was his standard line. So he was a type that just said, hey, listen, I hired you. I need to focus in on these things over here. So I don't want to be questioning you about what we're doing, how we're doing, what I have to eat, when my rest time is, what we're doing for recovery. Why are we doing all these physical exercises? Why are we doing all this mental preparation? I trusted to hire you. You do this job. You do your job to its highest abilities. If I have a question, I will ask you. Make sure you know the answer. I don't need you to guess, because if you have to guess, I can guess on my own. So Michael would just let me do what I needed to do. I put the plan into place, put the nutrition into place, whatever it was. Here we go. Kobe questioned everything, every little detail. He wanted to know why this exercise, why am I eating this? How come you have me drinking this much water? Why do you have this many reps on it? He wanted to know every single detail, everything. So that was the mindset and the way they worked out was totally relentless. I never had to tell them to show up. They were always there. I never had to tell them to work hard. All the basic stuff that you hear from everybody over and over again, they already know those things. And another big difference was Kobe worked out harder. Michael worked out smarter. Michael knew when enough was enough. He would be like, okay, I've maxed out today's workout. My body can't go up. My body can't do anymore. I'm physically drained. I'm mentally no longer here. That's enough. With Kobe, it was because he was chasing MJ. He was chasing that ghost of the six rings. For him, it was always about more. It was always about more. It was always about more. And that's one of the reasons he had so much trouble with his knees starting, you know, in his career, in the middle of his career. And I actually had to get him. I say, listen, we need to do less of these things. We need to do less of these exercises. We need to change your running pattern. We need to do less jumping here. We need to do more landing on this surfaces. So there's all this different stuff where I had to, in order for him to excel, instead of addition with Kobe, I had to subtract. I said, we need to take this out of your workout, and we need to add these small pieces in here to allow you to get back. And there was a struggle initially, because you tell one of the greatest athletes who's gotten to such a high level by continuing to outwork. And now you said, hey, listen, I actually need you to work a little bit less before we can have you work a little bit more again. And it was a struggle, but obviously we all got to see the outcome.
Yeah, and look, the outcome was amazing. In my book, I've still got Jordan 1, Kobe 2 in this world, probably LeBron 3. LeBron is almost unfair because I feel like he was born with the perfect body, whereas the other two had to work on it to get to where they needed to be, and LeBron has this God-given, I mean, it's the perfectly built basketball body football too, anything. Jesus Christ. I mean, that guy's physique is unbelievable. With Kobe, the biggest surprise, and you know, going back to him and Jordan, was I didn't know how close the two of them were until Jordan's speech at the funeral. obviously you knew.
Yes.
That relationship, what was that like behind the scenes over the years? Because we got to hear a little bit of it from MJ. I'm curious your perspective on it.
I mean, so what it was is MJ was very open to helping out the younger guys. It didn't care. It didn't matter who it was. So the players would ask him a question and Michael would give them the answer, say, hey, this is what you need to do. But he would watch to see if you actually did it. Because if you didn't do it and you asked him for another piece of advice, he was going to have some choice words for you saying, hey, I told you something to do before and you never even did it. The one thing with Kobe, every time Kobe asked MJ about something, he followed through. You could see it in his game. You could see it in his mentality. You could see it in his approach. So Michael was like, okay, now here's a real student. Here's a person that really understands what it takes to win. To win over and over and over again. So that's why Kobe could call MJ at 3 o'clock in the morning. That they could talk after games. I mean, it was amazing when you would watch a Chicago Bulls and a Lakers game. The bus and the plane was always delayed because both of them, Kobe would come out. And he would talk to Michael if they were playing at the United Center, and they would literally talk after the game for about an hour and a half, just the two of them.
Yeah,
just the two of them. And they were it would be the initial things about how the family is, all the pleasantries, and then after that, it was straight about competition, mental preparation, how to do this, how to do that, and they would have these lessons back and forth. And you would see two individuals cleanly dressed, like Lily, going through different footwork patterns, near the locker rooms and all this stuff, discussing different things and so forth. And it would be the same thing when they were at the, when they were in LA. It would be, Kobe and then MJ, they would talk afterwards and go for it. And it's funny, Michael was more willing to talk to him if they won. If they didn't win, the conversation wasn't quite as long because, he's still a competitor. I still want to beat this young kid over and over again. But that was the relationship that they had. They could talk anytime. And Michael did truly think of him as a little pain in the ass brother that wanted to always get better, that always asked a lot of questions, that wanted to be the best version of Kobe Bryant that he could be.
Why do you think their relationship remained so private then? Because, in the media, when Kobe was playing, they would always compare Kobe to Jordan, who would win? Mm-hmm. Nobody ever said anything, really. And truthfully, until The Last Dance came out or until The Funeral,
sure.
I didn't understand. I didn't know the answer. I think if Kobe would have come out and just said, hey, I talk to Jordan all the time, the debate probably would have ended, but he never said anything. And it never really materialized until afterwards.
Yeah, you know what? Two very private individuals. Very, very private individuals. Not very, obviously when Michael played, there wasn't any social media. When Kobe played, it was a little bit, and he kind of got involved into it more in later on in his career. But his early part of his career, he didn't. They had a mutual respect. The information they were sharing was to be shared among each other. And, when you have different people that are in the same mind frame, the same thoughts about winning, and maybe in the same sector, they respect each other's privacy. They respect the information that one person is willing to give to the other. And they know that they've been selected to receive this information. Winning has opened the door to this relationship between the two of them, and they need to keep it that way because obviously there's going to be things that are shared. There's going to be things that are said that they didn't want anybody else to know. They didn't want anybody else to know how close this relationship was. And Michael wasn't going to allow that same information to go to everybody else. And Kobe was honored that Michael was passing this information on to him. And he didn't want to disrespect him by saying, hey, I get all this stuff. I'm sure there was some communication between them that I wasn't privy to, that they were just saying, hey, listen, this is something special. I don't do this with everyone. Let's just kind of keep this between us, because the rest of their lives was so public. Everything they do. I mean, nowadays, if you're a celebrity, you can't go anywhere without somebody taking a picture of you, putting it on a social media, so forth. So this was their private time for them to understand the winning mentality they had between the two of them.
Yeah, when you say it, it makes sense. And boy, as far as tops in the world, those are the two guys. So I understand why it would probably remain private. I'm curious though if because it what we talked about earlier with Jordan having essentially one friend, it seemed like in that documentary. Did Kobe have a lot of friends in real life? It didn't seem like it. I met him one time out in L.A. and because my first job actually was when I moved to Los Angeles was I worked at the Staples Center. I was a waiter for the luxury boxes at the Staples Center. And there was one guy in there because we had to go and set up really early. So I was there when the arena opened and, young kid out of college, just moved to L.A., trying to meet some agents and all that stuff. It was one guy who was always on the floor training and practicing, and it was Kobe Bryant. And I'd asked, I was like, who is that? And they were like, it's Kobe. And they were like, get used to it. He'll be the only one here at this time when you walk in. And I was like, all right, it makes sense. But the one thing that, having seen him at Staples Center all the time and then later on in life, like at celebrity events and things like that, it didn't seem like he had a lot of close friends, and it didn't seem like Jordan did either.
Let me ask you this. How do we start this interview?
Yeah.
And you said, do you have a lot of friends?
True. Yeah.
So you already answered that question.
Yeah.
You already answered that question.
Yeah. You just wonder, because there is this mindset. You wonder if it's too much or if you're being too big of an asshole or whatever. But
see, here's the thing. The people that understand you, that respect you, they want you to be that same person. They don't want you to be somebody different. They don't want you to be somebody different. All right. And they have to accept you for who you are. Because here's the thing. Listen, Whitney knows all your secrets. Everybody that are close to you, they know who you are. They want you to be that same person. I want to talk to somebody the same way that I want to know who that person is. I don't want to know that fake person. I do this thing when I do a lot of my talks with business individuals. I always tell everybody, I say, listen, hey, pull out your cell phones. And everybody pulls out their cell phones. I said, pull up your social media profile picture. I don't care if it's on Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, whatever it is. And people pull up their Facebook, their pictures on it. And I said, there is none of you look this good. Not a single person in this room looks that good. All right. So I said, if you're constantly living your life through filters, eventually it's going to translate into your real life, because that fake thing that you portray out there is going to end up being who you really are. And I don't want to know that fake person. The one thing that's great about every individual that I've always dealt with, you got to see the real Jordan. You got to see the real Kobe. You got to see the real Wade. You get to see these real people, the way they compete, the way they are in front of the camera, all these different things. That's who these individuals are. And that's what we respect, because how many people in life want to be that way, but they're too afraid what anybody else is going to say about them.
Yeah, it's true. And, since you brought up Wade, he was next to my hit list here. He seemed a little more open to the press, the media, the public, friends, having friends, social gatherings. He was a little bit more Hollywood than everybody else as far as the events he went to. But he was still a winner.
Yes.
And the driving force, in my opinion, behind those teams winning in Miami. What was the strategy with him versus Jordan and Kobe? Because he did seem like he had a lot of friends and wanted to do more, social events and things like that.
He did. And then that's who he was. I was like, hey, he really enjoyed this. He really enjoyed the limelight. He enjoyed the stardom. And, there's a bit, and he living in Miami and, getting a county named after him and having all the success as a young player and so forth. So he wanted to relish all that. He wanted to enjoy it. And there was a lot of times where it did interfere with things, and we had to kind of like, hey, some of this we have to curtail back. We got to slow down a little bit, but we couldn't take it all away from him, because unlike how serious Kobe and MJ were And that seriousness fueled those individuals. If I would have tried to make Wade into that individual, it would have not worked with him. So there was a little bit more balancing that need to be done with, hey, yes, he's going to be more cordial to the media. He's going to be smiling a lot more. He is going to show up at all the fashion events. So we have to figure out how can we incorporate all these different formulas into his play and still allow him to excel at the highest level. Because you hear this all the time, and I know you go through this, you know, there is no balance. There is no balance. And what we do is everybody says, you got to balance this thing out. What somebody else's balance is and what somebody else's definition of success is and definition of winning isn't yours. So Kobe and MJ, they created their own balance. What was unique to them? Dwayne, I wanted him to create his balance that was unique to him. Not find it. You have to create it. So you get to decide what things stay on what side of the scale and how you want to balance that scale. How should they tip? How should they move back? How should they move back and forth? And it's unique to each individual here. And you can't find everything in a perfectly balanced. You just not. If everything's perfectly balanced, equal, what did we say earlier? It's average. That's what everybody goes through in life because they want to keep everything level. And you can't keep everything level. Something has to give. But that's your decision on what's going to give and how much of it you're going to give.
Yeah, and that's the toughest part about life, to be honest with you, is the balance. I've got a wife and two kids. You always wonder if you're spending enough time with them, being a good enough father, a good enough husband, and then trying to juggle work and your relentless pursuit for perfection, essentially, and trying to be the best at your craft. And that is a never-ending question and battle that only goes on inside my mind. And I'm sure everybody else's, but I'm curious, you give somebody a notebook or something and say, all right, let's try to figure out schedules, time. How do you do it with people? Yeah.
Yeah. So what I have is, everybody, the one thing I do is I said, you have to learn the mastery of the art. No. You have to learn to say no. You have to learn to say no. And then once you say no, there's no explanation after it, because if you have to explain it after it, that means you're unsure of the no. So it's like this, that's the one thing we all have to master. Then there's a muscle that I train in all my athletes that I don't think so many other individuals train. And it's the IDGAF muscle. And for a lot of individuals, that muscle is so weak. If you're going for something and that has to, and you put that list together, you put that not to-do list, that done list. This is what I want to get done. Not what I want to do. This is the stuff I want to get done. All right. Because there's a big difference between just doing it and I'm going to do it to get it done. You have to flex that muscle often. You have to flex. You have to know when to flex that muscle, and you have to know how to flex that muscle, and you need to use it oftenly. That way you know what's on your list. You know what you have to get done in order to manage your schedule. The other thing I do with these individuals, including my business clients, is I was like, we do something that's totally backwards. We try to manage time. Everybody's out there is trying to manage time. You know, they're trying to put all these things into the time compartment. You know, I'll do this from this time. And then everything gets done. I always say, don't manage time, manage focus. Because when you manage focus, you actually have more time. Think about all the times when you're really focused on something. You have no idea how much time, whether you've been doing it for 5 minutes or you've been doing it for an hour. You're so focused on what you're doing. And when you have that ability to focus, you actually have more time to get things done that are on your done list. If you're managing time all the time, that list never gets completed. So that focus, manage focus, don't manage time.
When you're so heavily focused in on one singular thing, time escapes you. At least it does me. Even days. Like I don't know what day it is today. Right. I walked in and my wife was like, all right, it's Friday. But I do the same thing every day. And I try to keep a pretty strict and rigorous routine that I do the same thing that I do on Monday that I do on Friday, so it really doesn't make a difference to me, you know, as far as what day it is or anything else. How do you manage that, the focus versus the time, where when you are focused on something for so long, there's got to be a stopwatch or a phone or something to cut it off.
And that's okay. There is that. It's how long can you, we all have distractions. We literally, listen, we have more distractions than this little thing available to us than anywhere. It's okay to be distracted, but you can't be distracted for a long period of time. The ability, the most successful individuals, and again, not just about money, I'm talking about successful, whatever they want to do, they have the ability to be focused, take a moment to be unfocused, relax a little bit, recharge, whatever it may be, and get right back to focus again. They have the ability to bounce back and forth. You have most individuals, once they get focused and they get unfocused, they can't get focused again. Now they start to manage time over and over and over again. Listen, I like to see a puppy rescue and a cat video just enjoyable as everybody else, or somebody doing something stupid that they post up and you're like, hey, what you doing? I get a good laugh out of it. I get a little break, drink my water, run to the bathroom, and then I'm back at it. And now doing that doesn't turn into more videos. Oh, let me go do this. Let me call a little people over here. That's when you start to run out of time. Listen, we're all human. We understand those. We all understand those things. Are you doing it because you're complacent and you just not really into it, or you're doing it just to kind of recharge and take a break? Can you have the ability to bounce back and forth, back and forth, back and forth?
I can. And for me, it's not distractions. It's time of, all right, there's not enough time in the day to do X. Like for me personally, I wish I didn't have to sleep. I just think it's a waste of my fucking time. I wish I could just work instead of sleep, but obviously you need sleep and it's important. What I was talking about was breaking down your day into times. Is that something you were doing for the athletes of, hey?
Yes, everybody had a routine, but the routine was so focus orientated. Here it is. And the routine, your routine allows you to excel. Their routine also allowed them to excel. Most routines, the people that have a hard time recognizing winning and seeing what winning is about, their routines are just to get them through the day. They're just like, we're just going to do this thing over and over and over again. And when this pandemic hit, for a lot of people, for them to be able to have a new routine and get something new, it was the best thing for them, because now they were like, okay, I have to get out of what I've been doing over and over and over again. And for the individuals that were like extremely focused routines, they struggled less during this time because they were like, okay, even though I may not be able to do things outside, I may not be able to see people, I may not have access to the same things, my strong routine that benefits me, that allows me to get a little closer to each win, allowed me to actually excel during those times. So it's what you put in that. It's what you put in that routine that's unique to you. I hate when people ask me this: what's your routine? My routine isn't going to work for you.
Right.
Your routine isn't going to work for me. You know, you look. Jordan's routine is not going to work for this person. Kobe and them, they all had a different routine. Everybody wants to know, oh, what does Tom Brady do? What Tom Brady does as a quarterback is not going to work for us. It doesn't happen. All right, yeah, it's nice to know. You can take a piece out of it, and then go for it. I get people all the time that ask me, what's the best time to work out? When you can work out.
Yeah, yeah.
There it is. When you can work out. People want to get so detail oriented. If you're asking me what the best time to work out is, obviously that means you don't work out. So how about just starting to work out first?
Yeah, I agree. I never ask anybody about their routines. Everybody's different. Whenever I see like Jocko posting, it's 4 a.m. and he's getting up, or, you know, again, Kobe and Jordan, all those guys are going to be different than the rest of us. I don't ask about routine. I don't ask about steps. I hate steps too. That's one of my biggest pet peeves of like, what are the steps to success? You know, I want 5 simple steps or 10 simple steps. I don't ask anybody about their fucking steps, because it's never ending. Like it keeps going. You should continuously be taking steps. Any book that's got 10 steps to succeeding to me is a sham, where it's like, dude, that is a staircase that never ends.
Hey, listen, that's actually in my book all the way. Because it was funny, when I wrote the book, everybody was telling me the best-selling books are the ones that have steps, because people want steps. They want a beginning and they want to start. And I was like, I am not putting steps in this book. I am not doing that. I said, it's infinite. I said, those steps are infinite and they're constantly changing. They're constantly shifting. I wish it was that easy. Like you said, there are no easy steps. Those steps change. They disappear. You don't know if they're underneath your feet. They're infinite. When you climb to the top, you look back down and realize you're still on the first step. And then sometimes you gotta run up those steps. You gotta crawl up those steps. You fall down. And I don't care. I always tell my athletes, I tell every individual, I don't care what kind of shape you're in, go run up a flight of steps. That shit is hard.
Yeah.
And it's all like, oh, 10 easy steps. Boy, we wish it was that easy. You know, and that's all everybody's looking for. People come up to you and ask you, what's the one thing? Boy, I wish it was that simple. I get people, you know, with this new book coming out, people are like, where can I get it? Seriously. You know, is it available in this? Is it available in that? You're so far away from winning and success that if you literally can't take the step to be like, to know where to get a book from these days, that's unbelievable. That's what people want you to do. They want you to, not only do they want you to show you the steps, they want you to do the steps for them and think through osmosis that you could just transfer the winning and success onto them.
The other part about it is, if you have to ask me where to get a book, that means you've never read one in your entire life. And I can't help you now, my man. Who's somebody that has reached out to you in real life that's you wouldn't think about, that was off the beaten path, that you're like, man, I can't believe this person reached out for help?
From a professional, obviously with a lot of my business individuals, they ask me to keep things a little quiet, but I'm that one individual that I'm like the last phone call a person will make when nothing else is going correctly, when the rehab processes aren't going right or the team's things aren't going. And unfortunately, I can't share those names, but I get a lot of calls from organizations where a player gets paid a lot of money and then all of a sudden they take that money and they for some reason, they forget how to play or they start to lie down and there's different distractions that come in and they ask me to kind of see what's going on and kind of clean that situation up. So I get that quite a bit.
You're like the emergency break glass type of guy where it's just like, all right, we need to get the fire hose. The whole fucking place is going to burn down.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And you see this all the time. You know, you look at the NFL play, you know, the NFL draft just happened recently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a National Football League. And for me, for a lot of players, that NFL stands for not for long, because you feel like I've gotten there and now I can exhale. It's just like, you know, in order for you to continue to have a successful podcast and for me to continue to have my successful clients in all forms of life, you got to continue to produce. You got to continue to evolve. You got to continue to get that result. Your rankings are only as good as your last podcast. My work is only as good as my clients allow me to be and the success that I have with them.
Yeah, and you know, with athletes, we've had a ton of famous athletes on the show. And I would say, because people always ask me this, like, you know, out in public, they're like, what was so-and-so like, or are these guys like? I always say it's this, it's 50-50. Half of them are playing for the money, and they don't really care about winning championships or being great or anything else. The other half actually do, and then they're on their way. It's so interesting, because you watch it on TV, I go, I can't tell you who it is because most of that conversation is off air.
Sure.
But I go, you know, I always tell them, I'm like, it's the people that would actually surprise you where you're like, really? That guy doesn't really give a shit about winning a championship? And it's like, no, they don't.
No.
They just want a paycheck, and they'll work their bodies as hard as they can for the paycheck, but they actually don't really care about winning. And that's always shocking to me. And when I was asking you earlier about somebody that would surprise you, for me personally, I like to talk to people who are the best at their craft, no matter what it is. I don't care if they're the best at backgammon or, you know, the best musician in the world. I was curious if like a Taylor Swift or somebody like that had reached out to you to be like, hey, I know it's not the same field, but I'd love to pick your brain about the guys you've worked with to see how I can apply their same winning attitudes to what I'm doing in my craft.
I get writers, I get actors, I get actresses, I get doctors, I get all kinds of all individuals in all forms of life, CEOs from companies, school teachers, you know, community workers, all that, to understand the mindset and the mentality that it takes to succeed, it takes to win. Because like you said, there's so much BS out there because everybody wants to make you feel comfortable. They want you to make it think it's not that hard, because easy sells. And there's nothing easy about success. There's nothing easy about winning. There's nothing easy about the language of winning. And that's what this book is about. It's to all these individuals that it's the raw truth. That's what it is. And a lot of these high-end individuals, you know, I get musicians, artists all the time, you know, top executives, rappers, all kinds of hip hop people. They constantly say, what do I have to do to constantly, you know, put out the next track, continue to stay on this top level? How do these guys win over and over and over again? And I sit down with these individuals and I tell them, hey, this is what it takes. And most people, the first thing they always do, I'll do anything. Until I give them my definition of anything is, and they'll be like, yeah, you know what? Not for me.
Yeah, there was a memo that leaked when I was in Hollywood for Brian Grazier, the producer. I don't know if you've met him in real life or know him, but one of the biggest and best of all time. One of the memos that went out was actually for a resume to be his assistant. But in that resume, it said, look, every week, I want you to bring in somebody every Friday who is the most interesting person in the world or one of the best at their craft, and I just want to talk to them for like an hour, hour and a half, and try to pick their brain about what they do. And it was like astronauts to like people who were, you know, the top of their tribe in like Africa and things like that.
Yeah.
And it was a really interesting look at constant ways to fulfill yourself in your brain, at least of different forms of greatness, because I think it all translates, or at least you can take a little nugget out of these conversations. Yes. And use them later on in life. But I don't think people actively seek out greatness enough.
No, they don't. Because once you have that, listen, you have a conversation with people that are great at what they do, and you have people that are average. That's totally two different conversations. They could be talking about the identical things. All right, one's having a winning mentality, one's having a relentless mentality, one is like, hey, I'm gonna overcome this, and you have this other one's over here. So one, you have a victim's mentality, the other ones you have a victory mentality. Both beginning with the letter Y, but here it is. One, V for victory over here, you know, V for victim. What do you want to do?
Yeah.
What do you want to do? And those people that constantly win over and over again, they want to hear that victory. They want to hear about the victory. And it doesn't matter what forms of what their endeavors are. They want to know it, because nobody knows what goes into somebody else's job until you get to sit down and see it, or you get to hear them talk about it, the things that you just wouldn't pay attention to. You'd be like, wow, they have to go through all these steps, and it's unbelievable. And that's how you continue to win. Once you take facets from everybody else and you're willing to learn from it. And like you said, take what you can use and don't take what you can't use.
Yeah. Man, look, I could talk to you for hours. I know you're a busy guy. This is the point in the show we get to the drinking bro of the week, which is someone who has inspired you or helped you become the person you are today. Who would you like to give the drinking bro of the week to?
Who would I like to give the drinking bro of the week to? Well, you know what? I'm going to give it to my new client that I started with about started in February. Russell Wilson, the quarterback for the Seattle Seahawks. That's going to be my drinking buddy.
Really? Russell, yes. You're working with Russell Wilson right now?
Yes.
Man, that's hilarious. I've gone in hard on Russell Wilson. I think it's too much personal life. I literally for the exact reasons we were talking about earlier in the show, because I host a big sports show as well. I've gone in on him because the personal side of the fame and everything else, and wanting to be out there. I was like, I wish that guy would work like Kobe and Jordan, but it's interesting to know that now you're working with him.
Yes, 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 it is. we can talk about that later on. Let's see what the end result comes out to be.
Let's see if he's still in Seattle. I'm curious about that. We'll find out about all of it. Before I let you go, because he was my favorite player of all time, when Kobe passed away, what was that like for you? Because I it was one of those moments for me. I knew exactly where I was and everything else, and I couldn't believe it. For a guy like you who spent so much time with him, where were you, and when did you hear, and could you believe it?
You know what? It was extremely difficult. I was actually in my office, and I remember getting the text, and I was like, this is fake news. This is something else is going on. Then I got a phone call from his office and saying, hey, this is actually true. And it was just like, I stopped, and it literally didn't hit me until 3 days later. I was sleeping, and then all of a sudden, it just kind of like, man, I was just like, he's gone. It's still not easy for me to talk to. I was actually at the Hall of Fame induction where his wife spoke, and she gave that eloquent speech. And to, you know, not to see him there in person, but to see him in spirit there, and knowing that MJ was there. So I got to see one of my top guys there, and I got to knowing the other person was there in spirit. It was bittersweet, but it's still tough for me, you know, even a year later.
Yeah, because it doesn't really feel like a year. It still feels like it was a couple months ago. And, you know, when somebody dies that young and they still look the exact same way, it's not like Muhammad Ali where you got to see a later phase in his life or something like that. Like, Kobe still looked like Kobe, where it was like, man, he could probably go out and drop 40 tomorrow. Absolutely shocking. Thanks for being here today. The book is called Winning. It is out everywhere. I do not need to tell you where it is out, because if you don't know, chances are you don't read books. This has been unbelievable for me. Thank you, Tim. I greatly appreciate you being here today.
My pleasure. It's an honor. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. For Tim Grover, I'm Ross Patterson. This is Drinking Bros.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.